sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Eurozone and Greece are at odds. Unemployment rate in the U.S. ticks up. Gold and silver plunge as the dollar rallies, and we have listener questions on this, The Disciplined Investor, episode number 399. Well, hello, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. We have a lot to talk about. It is now, where are we? We're in the beginning of February 2015, whereas January was a really poor showing for markets in the U.S. and around the world, and there was a lot of confusion as to earnings, economics, what was going on. But what was interesting was that we saw this massive turnaround right after that Super Bowl indicator said that, hey, we're going to have some more bad times. That tells you what that's all about, and that tells you the accuracy there. We debunked this pretty well on the DH Unplugged podcast last week. But last week was a good week, one of the best weeks we've seen in a number of years. And a lot of that has to do with not necessarily earnings, not necessarily economics, but the ongoing stimulus that is going on around the world. Now, listen, where are we? We're talking about 35, 40 days max of total time into 2015, the new year. And already we have seen a dramatic number of countries around the world providing for an insane amount of stimulus. Check this out. Russia, even though they're facing massive inflation, they're cutting down rates because their economy is in shambles after all the sanctions and all of the massive reductions in valuations due to their oil, their natural resource holdings. We see that China also decreased the reserve rate requirement for banks, allowing for more lending to go on. This is a series of steps that's gone on. We see that their economy is in contraction in terms of manufacturing. Ended below the 50 line last week, about 49 and a half. We saw that they're having all sorts of trouble trying to keep their GDP up. And what is happening? Well, they're now stimulating. Stocks in China, if you look at the Shenzhen Index A and the H, I don't know, 50 or 60% in the last 6 months or so. But wait, that's not all. Canada dropped their rates unexpectedly a couple weeks back. This is all in 2015. Australia dropped the rate. We saw that Europe is doing quantitative easing. What do we have now? So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 I just mentioned. Denmark obviously had to do something. They dropped and decreased, or I should say increased, went to more negative of the deposit rate. So to deposit money in Denmark cost even more money. So in other words, to fully explain this, if you would actually want to deposit money at the in Denmark, and you want to actually put money on deposit with the central bank, it would cost you money. So it doesn't seem like a lot of people would do that. Therefore, hopefully spurring loans and putting more money on the street. And then we have, of course, what they did in Switzerland, quite the crazy notion of delinking and unpegging their currency from the euro. And we saw what happened there, but yet it is a form of trying to at least do what they can to have as much money as they can inside their economy. Now we see this week India is injecting $1.1 billion into banks. So what we thought was potentially a chance for some global growth turns into a massive amount of stimulus action that's being done around the world. Now, does that help markets? Of course. Does it help economies? Probably not. Talked about this several different times about how, as a matter of fact, last week I was on Frank Curzio's podcast, Wall Street Unplugged. So if you haven't checked that out, Frank has a brand new podcast that's out. I think that's something that you really want to listen to. I was his guest last week on the Wednesday show, and we talked about all of this. And one of the things that I mentioned was that I thought that when you look at the stimulus and it's quantitative easing and various types of rate adjustments, et cetera, that have gone on by central banks over the last 5 or 6 years. What have they done? What is their real, what is the outcome when you look at what they've done? Well, it really has been just a rise in asset prices and really constrained to equities. Dropping in yields has definitely done very nicely, so that worked out well. But their main goal of inflation, increasing employment, well, I don't know if the employment situation would be better or worse if they didn't do the amounts of stimulus, of easing that they have done, if the interest rates wouldn't be as low. I don't know that answer. If an economy would have just healed naturally, probably not. They definitely had a hand in that because as you see companies able to refinance and change the amount they're paying out on various debt, that's a good thing for them. That helps the bottom line. That instills the ability for them to expand. And as such, well, what happens there is that as they're expanding, what do they need to do? They bring on human capital, obviously. But in terms of their inflation, in terms of bring back demand, I just don't know if it's doing the trick. You've seen that interest rates are as low as they can be historically in Europe, deflation. In the United States, I would beg to say that we're questionably on a deflation trend right now. We're seeing that in most of the countries around the world that are dependent on natural resources, they're seeing deflation. Japan has been for 20 years trying to revive the whole inflationary environment and has failed miserably by doing what? By trying their best to buy bonds, quantitative ease, and if they can, also to drop the value of interest and bring up the price of bonds and at the same time bring up their markets. It hasn't worked. It's failed miserably. So remember something. The job of the central banker at the very core is to balance the economy, to ensure that any action that is going on in an area that may envelop the entire economy isn't in such a way so overdone that the economy itself is really, you know, taken up or taken down too fast. So there's this equilibrium that they're trying to achieve. Very hard to do. You've heard of this soft landing, you know, as part of the equilibrium, right? You drive it up and then you kind of try to bring it back to equilibrium without smashing it. So the central banker job of balance and equilibrium is a very difficult one, but at the end of the day, they will say whatever they have to say. The same thing with politicians. I mean, central bankers are really politicians. Do you think that you're ever going to see a politician get up and say, well, hey, things are really too good right now. We need to slow down on this. No, they will be positive about it. When there's a negative environment, they will say it's looking better in the future. It doesn't matter if they're wrong, but yet we are all programmed to believe everything that they say. To really go along with the whole idea of, oh, the central banker knows. But you know what? If you ever looked at actually the outlooks and the projections of central bankers and of the U.S. central bank in particular, the Federal Reserve, and looked at their projections for employment, looked at their expectations for inflation, look at their expectations for the economy, man, they are bad. They are really bad. They don't do a good job at actually providing an accurate representation of their forward look. Yeah, and what they'll end up doing is, as time gets closer and closer, they'll revise and they'll look at their numbers. They'll look at where we're at. They'll revise. They'll look at the numbers. And eventually, they'll get closer and closer to the reality of what's happening. But looking out forward, if they don't have the ability, the tools, nobody else does. And at best, I would say that looking at an economy, I would say 12 months out, more than 12 months, is a fool's game. Trying to project anything more than the next quarter or so is ridiculous. There are so many variables that go into this. Really, let's think about this. This happens to be something that you really need to understand in terms of not only economics, but earnings as well for stocks. There are so many variables that go into this whole process. Now, from an economy standpoint, you have things like currency. That could play a major effect. You have weather. We've seen what happened last year or the year before that on what happens when weather acts a little funky, right? We have, beyond that, we have the issue of global political and geopolitical issues. I mean, you really have to look at what's going on around all of that to say, well, is it possible that we could really look a year out and understand what's happening? Sure. If you just look at a trend line, you just look at what is expected to happen, given all the circumstances that you have right now. But in a year, there are so many things that can happen that will change the dynamic, all of those things. And it really is a fool's game, I think, to really try to think about what's happening that far out. Now, moreover, to try to plan from a Fed basis, I mean, obviously they're trying to plan for a long time, that things will get back to normal and they can do reversionary and mean reversion types of strategies and theory. And I think that's hard. Now, the same thing happens with stocks. When you're looking at stocks, what happens? So you have all the things I just mentioned for economics in the big world, and you have additional issues, competition. You have things like change of management. You have possibly the cost factors associated with materials, a changing social agenda that maybe people don't no longer want pork, I don't know, whatever it may be. You have things that also are related to the balance sheets. Now you have changes of interest rates. You have possibly political and taxation changes that will change maybe the current tax rate and the potential for payment that you have. There's internal strife with employees. It could be lawsuits, and you can have legal matters that come up. There are a whole host of things that make it very difficult to project very far into the future. Sure, the next quarter, maybe at best two quarters, with the caveat that there could be outside influences that are involved, but really, maybe the next quarter is the only thing that we could look at. Now, looking at the next quarter, we have seen that many companies already are saying that, especially the big cap stocks in the U.S., look at the Dow 30 as an example, looking like they're very concerned about the next quarter. I talked last week about how the next two quarters or so of earnings and revenues are expected to drop significantly from the guidance that has been provided by companies. Now, again, as I mentioned, we don't want to go too far out here because a lot of things could really come into the fray. We could see a direct turnaround of the dollar and a drop. We could see the gas prices go up or go down further. We could see that there is the passage, which would be kind of crazy, of Obama's budget, where there includes approximately 15% or so tax on assets outside the U.S. and earnings and revenues of companies that have that. I mean, again, a lot of things that go into this. But when we look at the trend that's happening right now, we're clearly seeing that a gross change in the growth level of earnings in the U.S. on U.S. stocks. And a lot of that we probably could say is attributable to things like the dollar headwinds. But yet at the same time, the Dow Jones had like a 650-point gain last week, pretty much shrugging off all of the concern that was shown from the recent earnings that were released from major companies that said that, hey, you know what, we really are concerned about what's going on with relation to the dollar being so high and the headwinds we're seeing in emerging markets and other countries around the world in terms of the revenues that we're receiving. But right now, once again, central banks trump all of that. The idea that there'll be some kind of a stimulus program that will be put in, and the fact that Kashlakara, one of the Fed speakers, said, hey, you know, maybe we should start bond buying again if inflation targets aren't reached. Meanwhile, our unemployment rate ticked up a little bit to 5.7. A lot more people that have added themselves to the labor pool. Therefore, the participation rate moved a little bit higher. Of course, that's used as a benefit. It's a good thing when we see the jobless rate tick higher and kind of avoid it entirely when it ticks lower. It's kind of the way things are. We see a half full. That's what economists do most of the time. Most economists, most politicians, we see it half full. They say it half full. And what that means is that's a good thing. So about 200 plus thousand people added to the payrolls. Now, I mentioned something, and I, before we get to listen to questions, I want to flush this out a little bit. I got to tell you, it's very interesting, almost fascinating to me, that we're seeing all this hiring go on and a steady stream of it, even after we should have seen some retail really put some part of the part-time workers and the seasonality of what happens in retail. It should have been a little bit less employees that were added, if nothing else. I mean, maybe not fired, but less added. And then also, the number of people that have been fired, let go, due to the oil prices dropping in Texas, Balkan region. You know, look at the the upper west side, if you will, of the U.S., you know, kind of that region with North Dakota and all that, and some areas on the East Coast as well as Texas. And, you know, and you're looking at a high number of layoffs. Now, there could be also some internationally. It could be really not seen very well. But last week, we saw another sub 300 initial claims. That was very good. We saw that over 200 something, 50,000 or so new employees were added to the payrolls. Very good. Unemployment ticked higher, but again, looking at that from an objective standpoint, not the worst thing, kind of 0.1, you know, a very small move either way. No trend being established. If anything, it's an aberration right now from what we've seen. So where are all these layoffs not, and why are they not showing up? I find it very interesting. I don't find it conspiratorial. I just find it interesting. I'd like to see what's going on. Is it really that strong, the employment situation, when we're seeing that factory orders have dropped dramatically, durable goods orders have dropped dramatically, we're seeing an okay, just a continuation of the ISM service index. One of the things that there was a lot of excitement for initially on Friday with the unemployment number also came the wage growth number. This is something that we've been looking for a long time. When are wages going to start to move higher? Now, possibly that big bump that we saw is going to be a one-time wonder, because we saw that the minimum wage number was kicked higher in January. So you're starting to get some of that into the system, and that's good. But I don't know if you're going to see the continuation of that, because if it was just a minimum wage increase requirement in the beginning of the year 2015, and that's what's showing through right now, I don't know if you're going to see much more of that moving forward. Right? It makes sense. It was a one-time move. So I think there's nothing to get too excited about. Now, markets initially were pretty excited about this. Bonds sold off again. Bonds have been selling off pretty good over the last week or so. Again, a pretty big run on equity markets last week. And a lot of it had to do with the fact of anticipation of the jobs numbers, but also because there was this on-again, off-again grease thing that's going on. Now, let's kind of talk about this, because we need to understand what the problem is here and why it affects us. First of all, let's put in the backdrop that I think there's something that we need to understand. That economy and earnings and geopolitical issues are probably things that are running everything right now. Okay. Of course, central banks are part of this. But that's what all the news and the quick moves and the drops and the trends are all based on right now in terms of U.S. markets. Let's also say that in terms of economics, things are just stable. That's good. Nothing bad about that. There is some slowdown in the manufacturing sector. And I mentioned the factory orders. I mentioned durables. I mentioned the actual ISM factory numbers. Consumer confidence is at a high. That's good. Not really flowing through to retail very much, but okay, still good. There's still a lot of enthusiasm. There's good confidence. That's good. Now, earnings. Earnings, I would say, is at least if you look at it as a neutral, positive, or negative, right now it's a negative. This is probably the first quarter that we're starting to see a significant slowdown, something that was expected for a while, but the actualization of this is really flowing through right now. Okay, so let's say that we see economics, neutral, earnings, negative, geopolitical. That's the other thing. Put Russia aside for a second. Let's talk about what's going on in Greece and why this matters. So we know that the opposition party won the Greek elections, and they said, you know, pretty much, F you to Europe. We're not going to be dealing with this. We're not going to take this anymore. And this kind of one flew over the cuckoo's nest kind of stuff. What we're going to do is thank you very much for the bailout. Listen, what we want to do. Hey, either take it back, because we really didn't want it anyway. Our unemployment rate is very high right now. The austerity isn't working. None of the programs that are really imposing on us is working. We see this as a financial occupation, as a matter of fact. We see this as deliberately trying to hurt us, the poor Greek that didn't do anything wrong in the financial crisis, but yet everything's being dumped on us. Okay, well, now what they want to do is they want to write down. They want to renegotiate. They say, you know what, these bonds that we had, you know, that you bought from us and all this stuff that we have going on, you know, we don't want to default, of course, but you know what, we want write down. And Europe's like, really? Here's what we're going to do. You are going to stick by the program that we set out that you agreed to originally. I don't care that you have a change of government right now. And that's it. End of sentence. Now, what happened last week is that we knew that there were some negotiations going on, but Draghi came out and ECB came out and said, you know what? Thank you very much. Want to let you know, though, that what we're going to do is not only going to hold you to this, but no longer does Greek debt qualify for the waiver that we gave you, because don't forget, you had to have investment grade in order to allow for the debt that you have to be used as collateral for more money. Double dipping, so to speak. So that really put a crimp in things earlier in the week. Things reversed down pretty hard. About a 25-point move in the S&P 500 on that news. And then, that night, or that day after, Europe said, well, you know, by the way, we'll give you about $9 billion bucks to make sure that your banks still kind of float. Like, you're scratching your head going, what is going on around here? I mean, really, on one hand, you tell us that we're not allowed to use the cloud, but you're going to give us all this money? How does that work? And at one point, they thought that, well, Greece, while they came in pretty strong, they look like they're going to have a much more conciliatory tone at this point and back off and come into this whole thing and say, well, maybe we're not going to be involved. Now, again, fast forward through all the ridiculousness of the negotiations. Germany saying pretty much you got to stick by the plan. Greece not wanting to do it. Greece obviously only having about a month and a half until all their money runs out. Now they get some more money, maybe a few more days. But nonetheless, where is the problem in all this? Who cares? I talked about this several times. I just want to make sure you're clear about this. It is not that Greece matters as much on the global economic, you know, the big picture. They don't matter that much. They don't have a lot of exports. They don't have a lot of things that we need, a lot of things that we're involved with, or that the rest of the world is involved with, frankly. Travel is a major issue there. Well, again, that's an internal. Here's the problem. If Greece causes this hoo-ha and this ruckus and actually gets some kind of benefit and allows them to either write down debt or to defer debt or to do anything that may be beneficial to their debt structure and their austerity program in terms of allowing them to have less austerity and more spending, if you will, the rest of the countries inside of Europe are going to stand up and take notice and say, wait a minute. You're going to tell me that Greece, who is a major problem, and you put all this money to, doesn't have to stick to the austerity program? Well, we don't want to do that anymore either. And in fact, wait a minute, let me get this straight. You wrote down their numbers because why? Because they had a change of a government that said, no longer do we want to pay this? Well, you know what? I don't want to pay it either. Because you know what? The underlying civilians, the populace of those countries, Spain, Portugal, Italy, are going to be really pissed off with their leaders if they have to maintain an austerity program, stick to the guidelines of the whole deal. If they see that Greece got something, because you know what? They're all just like everybody. It's not fair, man. It's just not fair. These guys got this and oh my God. Okay. So I think when we look at this, we have to realize it's a matter of dominoes. It's a European domino. If in fact there is going to be any kind of write down, any kind of benefit given to Greece on this, any negotiation that goes even a smidgen in the direction of allowing for Greece to have less onerous guidelines for the entire program, any part of it, I don't care if it's just one little bitty benefit, there's going to be a bunch of other places from a political standpoint having to step up and say, we want that too. And that is going to be very expensive and very problematic for Europe. Where does that fit in? Well, that fits into us here because now that all of a sudden is a great deal to do with the banking, investment, and economy when it relates to the U.S. Does that make sense? There's a lot of overlap when we look at the Eurozone, not Greece, but the Eurozone, and all the things that are involved, particularly with our banks involved, with the banks over there, investment that we have over there, investments of companies over there, as well as the fact of many of our companies do business over there and vice versa. So now what we're talking about is Greece is really just a pressure cooker for the rest of the Eurozone. That's what's going on. It's an experiment in the rest of the Eurozone. How bad can things get? What are the changes that are going to have to be imposed? So again, look at Greece as just one little piece of whatever happens there is going to happen to the rest. And if in fact there is any consolation given to Greece due to the fact that they're, you know, crying and wah, 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 that they don't want to do along with this program anymore because it's not working for them. Well, you know, this is what happens when you get yourself in trouble. And by the way, Mr. Grease, you would have been in default. What would have happened? Your 25% unemployment rate, you would have been in massive depression, much worse than you were in. So keep that in mind and, you know, consider that when you're thinking about the whole issue when it relates to Greece, when it relates to Europe, when it relates to the U.S., okay? And Germany, obviously, being a major trading partner, France being a trading partner, Italy, et cetera, major problem. Don't forget about that. Italy has one of the highest levels of debt outstanding in the entire world and clearly the one of the worst GDP to debt to GDP as well. So think about that in the big picture of why it matters and why you're going to see this constant jockeying for position. And the fact of the matter is that Europe doesn't want them to make any changes, but they also don't want them out of the Eurozone. It's kind of a no-win situation, really, for Mario Draghi right now. But that's what you get when you put all this crap together and try to make it all happen. You know, put it all together and make all sorts of programs and plans and save people and, you know, and from different countries that are obviously different governments. That's the beauty of what we have here in the U.S. We don't have any of that crapola going on. It's not like a governor of Texas can stand up and say, you know what, hello, you know what, if you don't do what we're saying, we're seceding. It's just not happening. But that's pretty much what's going on in Europe right now. Let's get to some listener questions. And the first question we have is from Jeff. Actually, I think Jeff's from close to my old stomping grounds. He asked if I had a chance to speak on it. I wanted to get some discussion on student debt and the impact it has on the overall economy. You mentioned that he put three of his kids through college, but most of their friends can't afford to start their lives. The only way to grow an economy is to have young people starting families, right? Young families are high consumption consumers, high home buyers, autos, clothing. Young families buy everything. But they're so far in debt, they are living in their parents' basement. That hurts all of us. You know, it's interesting. I kind of have mixed thoughts on this whole college debt education issue. On one hand, I think we've made such a big deal about college education, which is important, but at what cost? The cost of putting yourself so far in debt that you have no way to really get out of it. And then, yes, I agree with you that while we want more people working and it's important to have an education and a specialty, but then at the same time, they don't spend money and that doesn't help the economy. So I think you're on the right track with this. I mean, I don't think by there's any doubt that the immense amount of student debt that's outstanding has really gone into such a level of ridiculousness that you wonder where the overall benefit for people and the economy. Because if you have a situation that everybody's educated, then you don't have any differentiation about who's going to be hired, right? Everybody's got the piece of paper, you get to hire them. You know, that's what your base level is. I just do wonder also in terms of, and agree with you, that if we are making it so much harder for people when they first get in life, see, I think that when you are young, before you have bills established, before you have a family, before you get into a situation where you're well over your head and you can't really breathe because all the expenses that you have are being consumed by, or the consumption of those are really killing and consuming all of your paycheck, and really you don't have any choices because now you can't move, right? You're stuck. Kind of get yourself in a bit of quicksand. And again, not maybe at your fault, but just the normal course of life, buying a home, getting an apartment, getting married, getting kids, you know, cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then you got insurance, and then you got, by the time you're done, now you can't change jobs unless you really got an upward opportunity, so you're really stuck. And therefore, what you should do is save as much money as you can early on. Very, very helpful. Is it impossible? Yes. The major impossibility is convincing people that they have to start saving early on. I mean, that's the bottom line. Because you want to get out there, you want to spend, you want to party, etc. But the problem is with the student debt, that's adding an extra layer of requirement. I don't know what we're going to see in terms of default on the student debt. There's been a lot of articles written about how the student debt problem is much bigger and the next possible catastrophe. I don't know how that goes. Because you don't really leverage up student debt, right? You don't like buy three different student debts, like you would buy three different houses and lever them up for investments. No one's out there really with student debt as an investment, right? I don't know, it's kind of funny to think about. But, you know, going to five different schools so you can get all the student debt and then have something to show for it as an investment because you only still have the same investment in yourself. And yes, you can get more money. Again, it's a much different situation than we saw with regard to the housing situation, you know, the housing crisis, where people were getting mortgages that were, you know, three and four mortgages and on different homes, and they would continue to second, third, fourth mortgage their current home and whatever they could pull out of it to then put down payments on others. And it was a gigantic level of leverage that was being used in order to create this empire. That didn't work out so well. Student debt's a little bit different, but the net result of it, I agree, is that there's less money going into the economy and spending. So I don't have an answer, man. I got to be honest with you. I don't have an answer to this. I know it's a problem. Do I think that less people should go to college? No. It would be morally bad to say. Do I think that we got a little bit crazy when it came with the college education? Yeah. I think that probably would have been a lot better to push up the educational standards in high school. To be honest with you, that would have been a lot better opportunity. But the competitive nature of the U.S., we saw that we were falling and fading, and so the powers that be said, you know what, everybody has to go to college now, and everybody goes to college. And it made it easier to get student debt, and now everybody's sitting there strapped with all sorts of student debt. So, Jeff, thanks for the question. I don't have an answer. There is no answer. There's nothing I can think of that is really an answer. I had another question from a young person who said, let's see here. Hi, Andrew. I'm a recent college graduate. Been listening for your podcast for the last few months. Noticed that you're a certified financial planner. Any chance that you could discuss in your show what the CFP certification allows you to do and what that process of obtaining the certification? It allows me to put letters after my name. It allows me and has taught me a lot of the basics of financial planning, estate planning, tax planning, investment planning, and there's about four or five different areas of financial planning. It doesn't, I'm just going to go to your question and then answer what maybe you're really asking. But your question was, is there anything that allows you to do? No, there's nothing that it allows me to do. It does allow me to have clients understand that I do know what I'm talking about when it comes to financial planning, investing, et cetera. Now, I think what your question really is, when you're asking about the process of obtaining it and where's the benefit, that's, I think, what you're asking me here. So when I took the CFP program back in 1990, there was six parts, six different tests. You took the tests, you passed them all, and you get your CFP, plus some on-the-job kind of stuff and time in the field, etc. Now, today's a little bit different. There's more of a comprehensive test that's a little bit harder, I understand. It's a bit more difficult, etc. There's more of a rigorous course load. Basically the same course load. So it could be upwards of a 1 to 2 year program. You study it, you take the courses in retirement planning, tax planning. What else is there? I think insurance, there's a whole insurance quadrant and social benefits, investing, pension planning, estate planning, whole host of different, and I think educational planning, there's a whole host of different courses that are required for it that you can find out where to get that. Is it difficult? I thought it was difficult. I took it over a period of time. I was working at the same time, so I took it in the background. I was also out of school for a bit, so anything that when you're out of school, you got to kind of dial back in the educational process into your head for that kind of program. Is it good? Yes, I think it's a very good program for a very well-rounded financial planning type of understanding. There are other things, like if you want to be much more hardcore into, let's say, just let's say investing, just that quadrant. You want to maybe do the CFA program. Very difficult program. If you're going to lean towards insurance, you can do CLU, CHFC. There's also certification in technical analysis if you want to just deal with that. There's also certification in what was the other thing? Mutual funds and investing like that. So I think that it all depends on what you want to do. If you want to start with looking at an education understanding CFP that you can be very well-rounded if you're entering into the financial industry, I think that would be very helpful, especially if you're new at this and just out of college. I think that would be probably one of your better choices is to be looking at the CFP program. So, I mean, I think there's some good things that I learned from there. As a matter of fact, I use them to this day. I mean, a lot of times clients come to me and we talk about their investing and all that stuff. That's the exciting part of all. But then we're like, well, let's back off for a second. You know, let's take a look at the estate planning situation, how you have all this stuff actually titled. And have you ever thought about really making sure that the assets that you have are going to pass correctly to your beneficiaries? Let's make sure we're dealing with the right level of tax planning here. Because, you know, what I'm seeing here is that really you don't have this set up or that set up. You can really benefit yourself dramatically. Would that be something we can, let's talk about that. Let's plan on something. So there's a lot that goes into that. And I think that it's really benefited me for some time. Let's see. I have some other questions. I have Rick from Boise. And I got a lot of questions in. I answered some of them in some other times. I'll also mention, got a lot of emails, by the way, on GoPro. You know, I've been really hawking that short position for some time, right? You know that. And we saw the earnings. We'll talk about that in a second. A lot of emails came in about that. Rick from Boise. He said, listen to your show for a long time. Thank you for all the information. Okay. Looking into different options. What is the benefit of mutual funds versus ETFs or vice versa? Been reading up on these lately and really wondering and trying to understand this better. So, Rick, okay, this is a really good question, actually. This you can pay attention to if you have any kind of diversified portfolio or you're thinking about setting up a diversified true, whether it's your 401k, whether it's a portfolio that's not your trading portfolio, whether it's, you know, whatever it may be, but I want you to listen to this. So, Rick, what we do is that when it comes to looking at investments, if we're making a choice in a particular sector, non-stock now, if we're looking at a choice of a particular sector, and let's say that we want to invest, for the heck of it, let's just say the S&P 500. Well, that's an efficient market that has good trading and good volumes, good liquidity. It is well known, and there's not much benefit that we can say that a manager will get if we want to look at an active manager, passive manager in a mutual fund or an ETF. What we will do in that circumstance is we will look at an ETF. We'll look at an ETF because they charge a much lower cost than a mutual fund usually, and it can be traded intraday. One of the biggest benefits of an ETF, a highly liquid ETF, is it can be traded intraday versus just end of day. Mutual funds only trade at 4 p.m. each and every day. Buy and sell at 4 p.m. An ETF, you could buy throughout the day. So that's the major benefit there, as well as the low cost factors. The negative is that if, in fact, on the other hand, we want to look at investing in small cap companies in New Guinea, well, I don't know if an ETF is going to do it for me there. I probably want a manager that understands the language, the landscape, the economics, the language, has understanding about the tax situation, all the policy, everything about New Guinea and what's going on there. And I will hire a mutual fund manager, let's say, in that circumstance that has a direct, this is kind of an obscure example, but hopefully you understand what I'm saying here. If there is something where there could be a benefit to using active management, like looking at hedging foreign bonds, buying foreign bonds in emerging markets and maybe hedging out the currency risk, that would be something that I would use a mutual fund to do, assuming that they have the opportunity and understanding of what it is that they need to do in order to succeed. An ETF just can't do it in that circumstance. So again, ETFs are more of a mirror of a particular index or sector. There's plenty of them out there. We used an ETF, for example, bought an option, a call against it, on it for the XLE, which is the energy sector. Closed the position on Friday, by the way. But we took that from the lows when it was about 74 and bought the 80 call on it that ends in February. And it was right in the money when we sold it for a very nice profit on Friday, or the final piece of it on Friday. So when you're looking at an ETF, it gives you a sector allocation for the most part that is very low cost, that doesn't have any active management, that will just be passive, that will mirror and give you as close to an index or sector return that is possible. Whereas a mutual fund, what we like to do is not use the passive mutual funds. We like to use the active mutual funds for those areas that we can have much more active management and managers that are actually making decisions, because we don't find that when we have a mutual fund that is supposed to be just based on the index and comparative performance of the index, that they do much. All right, moving along. Let's see here. Let me go through some of these. Oh, here's one. Well, this goes right into this last discussion, actually. This comes from Delano. You talked about hedging, and in many of your recent podcasts, can you give us some examples of how this works? Well, that's a good question. So, hedging. It's a long, long-winded possible answer, but let's just go to this. Hedging can be basically looking to protect the upside or downside against a position or a portfolio. All right, so let's break that down. When we're looking at a portfolio that is based on, let's just say, stocks in the U.S., right? What is a hedge? A hedge could be, well, I'm going to buy these 10 stocks because I think they're going to outperform and do really, really well in good times and bad. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to short the entire market otherwise and just look for a offsetting return that is better than the market from my current positions. That's one type of hedge. The other hedge would be, well, you know what? I'm not going to fully hedge my portfolio, but you know what? In the event of downside, I'm going to buy some volatility. I'm going to buy the VIX. I'm going to buy an option. I'm going to buy an ETF. I'm going to look that if there is volatility, I want to hedge. Another hedge may be that, you know what? Right now, I am short. Let's see. I'm short GoPro, and I want to go long Ambarella. Again, that's a hedge against each other, or that's more of a different kind of a trade. That's an offsetting trade, but hedging, what it does for you is that it will smooth out returns over time dependent on what you're looking to accomplish. If you're just looking to have a go-go portfolio, hedging doesn't work. Hedging works when you're looking to have long-term returns potentially over time where you have markets that are giving you both sides of pluses and minuses, where you can actually put some hedges on when the trend goes south and then take them off eventually. It doesn't have to be right away or maybe not the right exact time, but somewhere when the trend changes and then take them off. You're going to lose money on your hedges, which you're happy to do as long as you're making money on the other side. Hedges should be a smaller position and portion of your portfolio, generally speaking. Otherwise, it's not a trend. It's not a hedge. What it is a position. So hedges don't have to be just on the short side. They can be on the long side too. So let's say that you had a portfolio that was fully short, 100% every stock you had was short. You can actually hedge that bet by buying a call on the S&P 500 or on the small caps. Does that make sense? Right? So hedges don't have to be only on the short side. You also may have hedges on currency. So for example, let's say that you have a portfolio that has some foreign bonds in it. You may want to say, you know what? I'm going to short that currency and buy, you know, the dollar and maybe somehow look at the reverse so I don't have any currency exposure. Same thing is true for example, gold and silver as examples. Those could be hedges in some realm of risk. You know, if things really hit the fan, I don't want to be just equities. I want to have some other things out there. So again, this can be a good grouping of either options, ETFs, long or short. It could be currency. So hedges work on different mechanisms, and it all depends on what you have, but usually it's going to work against something in your portfolio. Otherwise, it's a position that you have for just investment. Well, next, let's get into this whole discussion of GoPro and what happened. First of all, you saw that. Let me step back. Yeah, Twitter came out with some earnings. I thought it was really fascinating that the average users were dropping down on the metrics on average users, but their advertising was so good. And I started thinking about that, and I realized that some of the things I've been talking about lately about being really annoyed by all of the advertisers inside of the Twitter feed on my iPhone and realizing I'm like, man, it's like, Jesus, like every three different tweets is another advertisement in there. And I started thinking about that. That probably makes a lot of sense that Twitter is, what they're doing is they're really kicking out their users by annoying the crap out of them, but putting advertisers in there. And that's good right now, but I question whether that's going to last. A lot of, just looking at the trend and looking at the metrics in terms of the advertisement and the money spend and how much money they bring in revenue, there was a tremendous amount of upgrades done on the stock. Stock was up, I don't know, 16% at the end of the day on Friday. Really big move. A lot of that probably was a short squeeze on the reality that they had some opportunity. But I do think that the longer term, if you keep on seeing and by the way, Dick Costello, the CEO, was making more excuses once again about why their users are dropping, some BS that he's given. I really don't like the company. I really don't like the long-term nature of Twitter. I don't think it's going to be something that's going to be, growing at the level that everybody expects it to grow, like what they expect out of Facebook, as an example, which is the best example you could use. But GoPro came out with earnings. Now the stock was halted right when earnings came out after the close, and the company beat the crap out of estimates. I mean, really, pretty big margin beat on both earnings and on their revenue. Now, that was probably expected, and at least it wasn't expected, obviously, by the analysts, but I think the whisper numbers everybody expected, that they're going to have a pretty darn good holiday season. I talked about it was the must-have, absolute gift for the holiday. I've talked about it 100 times. I've been talking about this since November. If you haven't listened to this for a while, this is one of those moments of clarity that I call it. You know, I have had several of those in my career, just this absolute clarity. And then you don't know about it till after the fact, by the way. You don't really, you don't see the full extent of it till after. But, you know, you have these two where you see something and you're just like, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it's just this clear vision of what it is. A lot of times you can have a very good idea and it actually plays out really well. But I'm talking about just clear and moment of clarity. This moment of you could really understand and see what's happening. So it seemed to me that what I saw was that potentially after this quarter, this was a little bit premature, as I mentioned, that they're going to see a really good quarter in the holiday season. And then the potential is that pretty much nobody's buying cameras after that. Yeah, they'll sell some, but not at the level they were selling at all. So earnings came out and it looked very good, but their guidance was terrible, absolutely awful. And the stock, which initially popped on the removal of the halt, about 17-18% started to slide and started to hold very much, not hold their levels. And I started looking at this and saying, what is wrong with this whole story? And I started looking deeper and I realized that, well, it was their outlook and their guidance that was really low. It was really disappointing. So I looked further into it. And as I'm watching it in the after hours, I noticed that, okay, well, I couldn't short any. We were short already the stock. We couldn't short anymore. There was no shares available. So, okay, you had to sit on what you had. Not much you could do with it, but sit there and watch and see what happens right there. So stock started coming in, and by the time the conference call started and there was some other news about executives leaving and resigning, and stock was down about 2, 3, 4, 5%. Then all of a sudden they started talking further and really looking at the outlook, and stock was down about 15%. It finished the day in the regular hours on Friday down about 15%, or 13% maybe it was. Now, my thought was, even though they had this point of clarity I mentioned to you, was that they're going to have a good quarter and they weren't going to really guide down as much as they would this quarter. But moving forward from here is where the problems start. Now, you may see a revival of something possibly in the holiday season again. But by then, who knows? Maybe it's going to be the Apple Watch that will be the must-have item. Maybe it's going to be a pet rock again. I don't know what it's going to be, but the bottom line is that when we look at the overall potential of GoPro, now with all the competition that's out there, I just wonder about the longevity of this company in terms of anywhere near the valuations they have before or even now. Because if you note that there is going to be just the standard progression of technology, you know, Moore's Law, where we see that there is a shrinking down of something and a halving of the price, so a doubling of capacity, shrinking it down, but halving of the price over time, and maybe it won't move in that direction. But then you look at the competitive nature, you find that anybody that has a product that anybody, you know, wants, just look at the smartphone, the wearable, and now the camera market. I just wonder what this company is going to do long term. Could it be a buyout candidate? Possibly. Is it going to be something that's going to grow over time geometrically to a level that we're going to see that this is going to be a company like a Google one day or an Apple one day? Or I think more so it's going to be a company you know, that will continue to do okay, but probably more like a Panasonic, possibly looking at a Nikon, Canon. It's one product. It's all they have. It's one product and related items to that product, but one product. At least these other companies had many different products, a wide spectrum of products that they could sell in different areas. Now, maybe Canon is related only to, well, they have a lot more. They have copy machines and scanners and things of that nature. Still dealing with optics, but they have a lot more breadth of the product line. This is a one-hit wonder. And if anybody else comes up with a better product, by the way, easier to use, just think about what I talk about all the time, Diamond Multimedia. If you don't know who they are, they're a company that is currently out of business. But yet they were the inventor of the MP3 player. Pretty crazy. Well, in a way, GoPro is the inventor of the high-quality 4K sports camera, we'll call it, video camera. But you know what? Maybe they're not going to be the player that's there forever. So anyway, I got some nice emails from everybody that was playing the GoPro short, so I'm glad you made some money on that. We'll see what happens with this moving forward. We do have it for portfolios as a disclosure, and we have that in the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. So if you want more information on that, by the way, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Maybe it's a good time. I mention this all the time. It's getting, this year especially, maybe it's getting that time you want to look at some of the strategies that we have, because maybe we're not going to see the upward trajectory of markets like we've seen before, or even if we don't, or even if we do, maybe there'll be a lot more volatility, a lot more fun. Kind of better as an investor that is a trader, or at least a trader and investor, to have volatility than just simply having a directional market up or down. It just doesn't work as well. Okay, so you can check that over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We have also, as I mentioned, TradeStation Tuesdays, where we are looked at the oil companies very strongly, and oil did pop up nicely. We saw that great move of oil over the last week or so. Will it hold? I don't know. The rig count that we've seen, it dropped. We're seeing that there's a lot of rhetoric out there by the oil companies saying they're going to cut down production. But at the same time, we're seeing the rhetoric from the other guys over in Saudi Arabia said that they're not going to slow down on production. So about a 6 million barrel build of oil on Wednesday. This is after about, I think it was I can't remember the number now. Was it 11 million barrel build? It was some ridiculous number over the last few weeks that we saw a build on oil. And this is with prices going down. And by the way, did you notice that it took a long time for prices of oil to come, of gasoline to come down as oil was coming down, but we saw a little turn already. I'm seeing $2.40 after it was $2.02, 20% move, just in a matter of a week, right on the heels of the increase of oil. Gotta love that. But we're seeing that many of the oil companies, we saw a nice turnaround. So there's something. I think that what we're finding is that there is a level of production issues that you're going to continue seeing. Baker Hughes was the last one to put out their rig count to drop. Probably one of the most substantial drop in rig counts that I've ever seen. And that's all because of oil prices are low. And what they're going to want to do is obviously keep, at best, their production down to create that artificiality of production, supply, demand. So that's what's going on there. What else did I want to mention to you? I have a list of things. Let me just look. Oh, gold and silver did get whacked last week as the dollar came up. I thought it was really interesting to see that the dollar come up as much as it did on the unemployment note. I think it's just traders are just doing whatever they can, that anytime there is the potential to short the euro, to just hop right on board it. Euro did come up a bit over the last week or so, but this jobs number that showed what was interesting was that it was a better number than expected, but a worse unemployment rate. So again, they're kind of looking at whatever they want to look at. Plus the fact that over the weekend, nobody really wanted to be long. Probably was that nobody wanted to be long the euro going into another vote and another discussion about Greece. So that probably is going to be something to be reckoned with. And of course, I don't know how this is going to play out anymore, because it really become quite a non-event until it becomes an event. It looks like that Russia is not backing down at all in the Ukraine, and they're not giving a crap of what Merkel said over the weekend and what the conversation was. So we'll see what happens. This whole Russia debacle and Europe-Greece is really getting a little bit long and boring. I wish that we would just find out and get, kind of like, it's a disease that just is going on forever. You want to just, let's just either cure it or cut it loose at this point. Why have this suffering go on? Just, it's becoming very annoying. I don't know about you, I find it very annoying. I live and breathe this every day, and it's becoming not only annoying, it's becoming a distraction. So anyway, if you want to reach me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can also find more on triggercharts.com, where you can find all things related to our indicators that we have for TradeStation, as well as our three strategies over on The Disciplined Investor. You can go there and find the Arrow strategy, which is an algorithmic strategy. We have a brand new update, an update going back about 15 years with the current strategy. That you want to take a look at and look at, you have to look at the chart between the strategy and the S&P 500. It's pretty amazing. If you want that, go over and request a copy. We'll send you a full report, free report on the Arrow strategy over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll try to put the information in the show notes, or just search for Arrow, AIRO strategy. And that about does it. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again next week. We're going to have a great guest, I believe, next week. If you have any comments, please let me have them. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company. a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.